Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Kelly Jean Kelly and Steve Ember. But first, this report from Jill Robbins and Brian Lynn.
English learners all over the world have the same question. How can I speak more like a native speaker? A big industry has grown up around helping non-native English speakers change their accent. Accent is more than simply how you pronounce individual words. It also includes the stress and intonation patterns for whole sentences. There are many books and software programs, online and in-person courses, that promise to teach a native accent. But is it really necessary to sound exactly like a native speaker? Some experts say it is not. Eusebia V. Mont leads the Accent Modification Program at the University of Maryland's Department of Hearing and Speech Sciences. Mont talked about it to VOA Learning English.
The Accent Modification Program serves students, faculty, and the local community. Students come to the program for one or two school terms. They meet in a group for 90 minutes a week. Each student meets with one other student and a clinician for more individual work. Altogether, the program amounts to about 60 hours of learning in class. Mont says the time needed to improve is different for each student.
The rate of progress absolutely depends on the type of accent it is, how long they've been speaking English, how often they speak English, how much exposure they have to the language, listening and speaking. So it's a very individualized process.
Everyone speaks with an accent of one kind or another. People often say they want to lose their accent or lessen their accent. But it is more exact to describe such an effort as adding or modifying an accent. Mont says the purpose of accent modification is to give students tools to use when they need others to understand them more clearly.
Our goal is not to eliminate the accent. I view accent as an extension of culture. An extension of a person's individual identity. And I don't work to eliminate any part of culture from an individual.
Students in the program are looking toward the future. They will most likely work in English-speaking environments when they leave school. The program teaches them tools for this. For example, they learn how to give an elevator pitch, a short description of an idea, and to discuss their research. They also practice interviewing and giving presentations at work. The program teaches idioms and colloquial expressions as well. This helps students talk with native English speakers. The idea is to help them feel part of the English-speaking community in which they study, work, and live. Mont says that there are a few methods for modifying accent, but most have the same basis. One method is called the Compton method, or pronouncing English as a second language, or PESL. Arthur J. Compton developed the method in the 1980s for English learners who know English vocabulary and grammar fairly well. PESL teaching begins with a test to find out how the student's native language affects different areas of pronunciation. Then, learners use practice materials to record their own voice and compare their pronunciation attempts to recordings of a native speaker. Another method is the Tomatis method, which uses special headphones and includes listening to electronically modified music and voices. This method is also used as a therapy with children who have autism or other conditions that can cause difficulty in language learning.
The methods used at University of Maryland are based on data from tests of participants, Mont says. She has found that the best method is the one that works for the teacher and student. So the team may switch and use a different method if the first choice does not work. Learners who want to modify their accent often take a do-it-yourself approach, thinking they know exactly what to work on. But that is not as easy as it may sound. The participants at University of Maryland's Accent Modification Program learn how to listen to and examine their own speech pattern. They also learn to produce separate sounds and then work on intonation of sentences. Over time, they build confidence in speaking understandably in particular situations. Class discussions, phone calls, interviews, and discussions of their research. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
Whale researchers believe they have found a new way to help protect the animals from dying off. The researchers say they can study the mouths of dead whales to identify how often they faced serious threats, such as being hit by a ship. American Rosalind Rolland is the lead scientist on the project. She and her team are with the New England Aquarium in Boston, Massachusetts. They reported their findings in the online publication Marine Mammal Science. Rolland and her team studied baleen, a substance found in the upper part of the mouth of some kinds of whale. She explains that the baleen records each time the animal's stress hormone increases. Scientists can then read these records, similar to reading the rings on a tree. Understanding the information is important because whales, who often feel stressed, are less likely to reproduce and more likely to become sick. That combination is not good for the whale population, which is already dangerously low. The scientists did their work on a whale that had become trapped in fishing equipment. It was finally killed by Inuit hunters, who found it trying to swim in the equipment. The hunters said the whale seemed to lack energy. When scientists examined the dead whale, they found its mouth showed an increase in stress hormones 20 times greater than normal. Their research comes as fishermen, government officials, and wildlife activists struggle with how to protect sea animals. some whale species are dying off because climate change has affected their supply of food. Others are victims of accidents. For example, some scientists estimate that fishing equipment kills up to 300,000 whales and dolphins each year. Regina Asmutis Silvia is a biologist with the Whale and Dolphin Conservation in Massachusetts. She was not involved in the research, but she says it is important. The study shows that getting caught in fishing equipment does not just limit a whale's movements or ability to eat, she says. Getting caught also changes the body's ability to fight disease, have babies, and even grow. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Some Asian nations are facing growing pressure to support either China or the United States in disputes over the South China Sea. The South China Sea issue was discussed during a yearly security conference last weekend in Singapore. The meeting, called the Shangri-La Dialogue, was attended by more than 600 defense officials from 40 countries. Among the attendees were Chinese Defense Minister Wei Feng-he and U.S. Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan. Speaking to the gathering, Wei called for mutual cooperation among nations with competing claims to the South China Sea. He urged nations not to underestimate the wisdom and ability of regional countries to properly handle differences and maintain peace. China claims most of the South China Sea, an important waterway through which trillions of dollars in trade passes each year. The area contains rich fishing waters and is believed to hold oil and natural gas. The Philippines, Taiwan, Vietnam, Brunei, and Malaysia all claim ownership to parts of the sea. Several other claimants have criticized China for using undersea landforms in the South China Sea to build artificial islands. China has placed military structures and equipment on some of the islands. In his comments to the meeting, Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong warned of the danger of smaller countries being forced to take sides with larger ones. He said any talks or agreements should aim to help bring countries together rather than split them apart. Jay Batumbakal is a professor of international relations at the University of the Philippines. He told VOA he agrees that some smaller nations are already feeling pressure to side with either China or the United States. He said that pressure could increase if disputes between South China Sea claimants continue to escalate. The United States makes no claim to the 3.5 million square kilometer South China Sea. But U.S. officials have said they want to keep the waterway open internationally. The U.S. has passed naval ships through the sea 11 times since 2017 and flown B-52 bombers over the waterway in efforts to check China. Security experts say nations choosing to side with the U.S. risk possible economic punishment by China. But if countries choose to back China, the U.S. might cut off military cooperation. Huang Chunting is a Chinese political and military expert at the Institute for National Defense and Security Research in Taiwan. He noted that last year, China's defense minister issued a statement saying Chinese officials want to repair relations with its neighbors. He, Wei Fenghe, hoped there wouldn't be too many issues of excessive conflict, Huang said. In his comments to the meeting, U.S. Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan said the U.S. is continually strengthening its alliances and partnerships in the area. This cooperation has led to joint naval exercises with several other nations. I'm Brian Lin.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The House of Representatives ended the day's business early on the rainy afternoon of April 12, 1945. The House Democratic leader, Speaker Sam Rayburn, invited a friend to come by his office for a drink. "Be there around 5," Rayburn said. "Harry Truman is coming over." Harry Truman was the vice president at the time. The events are described in a book about his presidency, Conflict and Crisis, by Robert Donovan. World War II was not over yet, but it was a quiet afternoon in Washington. President Franklin Roosevelt was in the southern state of Georgia. He was resting after his recent trip to Yalta to meet with British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. The president's wife, Eleanor, was at the White House working on a speech supporting the new United Nations. Harry Truman was at the Senate, but he was not interested in the debate that was taking place. He spent most of his time writing to his family back in Missouri. When the debate finished, he went to the office of House Leader Rayburn to join him for a drink. It was an afternoon Truman would never forget. Rayburn and his friend were talking in the office before Truman arrived. The telephone rang. It was a call from the White House asking whether the vice president had arrived yet. "No," Rayburn replied. The caller asked him to have Truman telephone the White House as soon as he arrived. Truman entered a minute later. He immediately called the White House. As he talked, his face became white. He put down the phone and raced out the door to his car. Truman arrived at the White House within minutes. An assistant took him up to the president's private living area. Eleanor Roosevelt was waiting for him there. "Harry," she said, "the president is dead." Truman was shocked. He asked Mrs. Roosevelt if there was anything he could do to help her. But her reply made clear to him that his own life had suddenly changed. "Is there anything we can do for you?" Mrs. Roosevelt asked the new president. "You are the one in trouble now." Within hours, the world learned the news that Franklin Roosevelt, the longest-serving president in American history, was dead. He died of a cerebral hemorrhage, bleeding in the brain. Americans were shocked and scared. It was 1945, and the United States was still at war. Roosevelt had led the nation since early 1933. He was the only president many young Americans had ever known. Who would lead them now? All eyes turned to Harry Truman.
"Our departed leader never looked backwards. He looks forward and moves forward. That is what he would want us to do. That is what America will do.
Harry Truman, in his first speech to Congress as president.
With great humility, I call upon all Americans to help me keep our nation united in defense of those ideals which have been so eloquently proclaimed by Franklin Roosevelt. I want, in turn, to assure my fellow Americans and all of those who love peace and liberty throughout the world that I will support and defend those ideals with all my strength and all my heart.
Truman had been a surprise choice for vice president at the Democratic Party nominating convention in 1944. Delegates considered several other candidates before they chose him as Roosevelt's running mate. That was at a time when presidential candidates did not make their own choices for vice president. Harry Truman lacked the fame, the rich family, and the strong speech-making skills of Franklin Roosevelt. He was a much simpler man. He grew up in the Midwestern state of Missouri. Truman only studied through high school, but took some nighttime law school classes. He worked for many years as a farmer and a small businessman, but without much success. Truman had long been interested in politics. When he was almost 40, he finally won several low-level positions in his home state. By 1934, he was popular enough in Missouri to be nominated and elected to the United States Senate, and he won re-election 6 years later. Most Americans, however, knew little about Harry Truman when he became president. They knew he had close ties to the Democratic Party political machine in his home state. But they had also heard that he was a very honest man. They could see that Truman had strongly supported President Roosevelt's New Deal programs. But they could not be sure what kind of president Truman would become. History gave Truman little time to learn about his new job. The most important power he now possessed was the power of atomic weapons. And soon after he became president, he faced the decision of whether or not to use that power for the first time in history. Truman firmly believed that using the atomic bomb was the only way to force Japan to surrender. So in August of 1945, he gave the orders to drop the atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us. It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies. And we pray that he may guide us to use it in his ways and for his purposes.
Days earlier, Truman had met in Potsdam, Germany, near Berlin, with the British and Soviet leaders, Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin, to plan the peace. The war in Europe had ended several months before.
Good evening from the White House in Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, I have just returned from Berlin, the city from which the Germans intended to rule the world. It is a ghost city. The buildings are in ruins. Its economy and its people are in ruins. Our party also visited what is left of Frankfurt and Darmstadt. We flew over the remains of Kessel, Magdeburg, and other devastated cities. German women and children and old men were wandering over the highways, returning to bombed-out homes or leaving bombed-out cities searching for food and shelter. War has indeed come home to Germany and to the German people. It has come home in all the frightfulness with which the German leaders started and waged it.
The three leaders agreed that their nations and France would jointly occupy Germany. They also agreed to end the Nazi Party in Germany, to hold trials for Nazi war criminals, and to break up some German businesses. Foreign ministers of the Allied nations later negotiated peace treaties with Germany and other countries, including Italy, Hungary, and Romania. Eastern European nations agreed to protect the political and economic freedom of their citizens. However, Western political experts were increasingly worried that the Soviet Union would block any effort for real democracy in Eastern Europe. Truman did not trust the Soviets, and as he made plans for post-war Asia, he promised himself that he would not allow Moscow any part in controlling Japan. The leader of the American occupation in Japan was Army General Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur acted quickly to hold a series of trials for Japanese war crimes. He also launched a series of reforms to move Japan toward becoming more like a Western democracy. Women were given the right to vote. Land was divided among farmers. The idea of a national religion was ended, and the educational system was reorganized. Japan began to recover, becoming stronger than ever as an economic power. Truman and other world leaders were dealing with the problems of making peace. But at the same time, they were also trying to establish a new system for keeping the peace. The United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, and the other allies had formed the United Nations during wartime. But soon after Truman took office, they met in San Francisco to discuss ways to make the United Nations a permanent organization for peace. In July of 1944, many of the world's top economic experts met to organize a new system for the world economy. They gathered at a hotel in Bretton Woods in the American state of New Hampshire. They created the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to help nations rebuild their economies. At the center of all the action was Harry Truman. It was not long before he showed Americans and the world that he had the ability to be a good president. He was honest, strong, and willing to make decisions. I was sworn in one night, and the next morning I had to get right to the job at hand, Truman remembered years later. In an oral history recorded with the writer Merle Miller, Truman said, "I was afraid, but of course I didn't let anybody know that. And I knew that I would not be called on to do anything that I was not able to do. That's something I learned from reading history." Truman spoke of how people in the past had much bigger problems. Somehow, he said, the best of them just went ahead and did what they had to do, and they usually did all right.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.